Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mona Montgomery with the Hola Hoax. Tonight, we're in the middle of the war on Iraq, which is a continuation of the Second World War, in that it's a war orchestrated by Jews using white soldiers to further the interests of Israel. I have an excerpt of a radio show narrated by Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen on March 8th, called Carnage, The Real Face of War, in which they graphically describe that this war is no peaceful takeover by a liberating force, but is in fact a bloodbath in which the carnage is described in terms that you can really understand.
General anesthesia, pentotol, nitrous oxide. They're using ketamine, a five-minute anesthetic for the amputations. The surgical teams are injecting child patients with ketamine every few minutes to maintain effects. The shortages extend across the rack to gauze, tetanus vaccine, or any antibiotics to protect patients against infection.
In fact, Ralph, in Baghdad, they don't even have the ketamine. They are using 800 milligrams of ibuprofen. Ibuprofen, that is Advil here in the United States. Ibuprofen for amputations. And Lamones on March 5th reports that this terrible bombardment has been called by the American general, Michael Mosley, a complicated ballet. Complicated ballet is what he talks about, the way he describes the 2,000 planes that are above Iraq. 2,000 planes launched from 5 aircraft carriers and 30 bases in 12 different countries. 40,000 personnel mobilized just for the aerial strikes. And this is not the people on the ground. 40,000 personnel for this genocidal assault from the air.
Maya, Maya, the Red Cross on April 5th, just to amplify what you're saying, the headline in the story, Red Cross horrified by the numbers of dead civilians. Red Cross doctors across southern Iraq saw, quote, incredible levels of civilian casualties, truckloads of dismembered women and children, a spokesman said Thursday in Baghdad. Roland Huguenin, one of 6 international Red Cross doctors in the Iraqi capital, said that they are horrified by the casualties in Hila. There is an incredible number of casualties with grave wounds in Hila and across southern Iraq. Trucks are delivering hundreds of totally dismembered bodies of women and children. It is an awful sight. It is very difficult to believe the scale on which this is happening, the article goes on.
Yes, they say doctors worked around the clock to do as much as they could, but that's all they could manage. That's all they can try to do. They've toddlers of 2 or 3 years of age who've lost their legs, their arms. As the Red Cross says, we have called this a horror. And where did the people from Hila come from? They came from the village of Nasiriya. Now, this led Amnesty International, as well as the Red Cross, to disclose that many of these injuries were caused by cluster bombs. As the Amnesty International press release on April 2nd notes, on April 1st, many of the people coming into the hospitals around the town of Halhila were children, and that they were children and they had been attacked by cluster bombs. And Amnesty International is precise. The cluster bomblets used around Halhila are the BLU-97A/B, and each canister contains 202 small bomblets, the size of a small soft drink can. The cluster bomblets scatter over a large area approximately the size of 2 football fields. Imagine this. One bomb spreading over 2 football field.
You're talking about 10,000 slivers of razor-sharp steel, lacerating flesh like a machete. You're talking about thousands of BB-sized metal balls that perforate organs and render a pancreas and liver and kidney like a sieve. The victim's inoperable. ABC News on the 6th of April, Red Cross, the Iraqi wounded are too high to count. The number of casualties in Baghdad, the report states, is so high that the hospital has stopped counting the numbers of people treated, the International Committee of the Red Cross said Sunday. No one can keep an accurate statistic on the admitted and transferred. It is truckloads of amputees and decimated bodies. Ambulances are picking up the wounded and running them in the triage areas into hospitals. The neutral Swiss-run organization, ABC reports, the main agency left in Iraq, gave estimates of between 2,000 and 3,000 civilians reaching over the weekend alone in two hospitals. All the hospitals are under pressure. The medical staff is working without respite. It is an indication of the magnitude of the civilian slaughter in Iraq.
And Ralph, to go back to the cluster bombs, because Ralph has been describing the injuries that are taking place now from the JDAMs, from the cluster bombs, from the missile attacks that are coming from the tanks on the ground. But what Amnesty International notes, that at least 5% of the cluster bombs are duds. They don't explode on impact, and this turns them into anti-personnel mines because they pose a threat to people who come in contact with them. And we had described this last week, such as happened in Lebanon and in Afghanistan and Kosovo and areas throughout the world. And Ralph had described this goes all the way back to Vietnam. But what the United Nations has disclosed and what the United States continually denies is that these cluster bombs that end up in the fields throughout Iraq and in the villages are covered in a bright yellow plastic wrap, and that the color of the wrapping is identical to the food packets, identical to the food packets that were used throughout Afghanistan, and that children confuse the ration and the unexploded ordnance because of the identical coloring. And in Afghanistan, the food packets were dropped from airplanes, and just like the cluster bombs are dropped from airplanes. So when the kids see these packages on the ground, they pick them up, and there you have further lacerations, further amputations, if the children manage to survive.
Paul Peachy in The Independent, this is virtually a day-by-day account of genocidal slaughter. Here on the 7th of April yesterday is Paul Peachy in The Independent. Baghdad doctors overwhelmed, 100 patients an hour. Hospitals in Baghdad are overwhelmed by the huge numbers of the wounded brought in. Medical staff working round the clock without breaks are also hampered by power cuts, the absence of clean water. The one doctor, Osama Salah Dulami, who has witnessed two previous wars, stated, "I have been a doctor for 25 years. This is the worst I have seen in terms of casualty numbers and fatal wounds."
Now, let us look at what the Marines on the ground are also doing. An amazing, revealing report was published in the Times in London on Sunday, March 30th. It's by Mark Franchetti, and he's reporting from Nasiriyah. U.S. Marines turned fire on civilians at the Bridge of Death. Now, Mark Franchetti was an eyewitness to what took place, and it is riveting, it is horrifying, and it proceeds as follows. Some 15 vehicles, including a minivan and a couple of trucks, were blocking the road. They were riddled with bullet holes. Some had caught fire, and others were turned into piles of black, twisted metal. Others were still burning. Among the wreckage, I counted 12 dead, lying in the road or in nearby ditches. All had been trying to leave, that is, evacuate the southern town overnight, probably for fear of being killed by the U.S. helicopter attacks and the heavy artillery. One man's body was still in flames. It gave out a hissing sound. Down the road, a little girl no older than 5 and dressed in a pretty orange and gold dress lay dead in a ditch next to the body of a man who may have been her father. Half his head was missing. Now, the quotes from the Corporal Ryan Dupre. The Iraqis are sick people, and we are the chemotherapy. Wait till I get a hold of a friggin' Iraqi. No, I won't get hold of one. I'll just kill him.
I saw the heads of my 2 little girls come off. The Sydney Morning Herald. An Iraqi mother describes how her 2 young daughters were decapitated. The children's father was also killed. I saw the heads of my 2 little girls come off. I watched the heads come off their bodies. My son is dead. And then in Reuters, U.S. raid hits Iraqi hospital, multiple casualties. U.S. missiles struck a Red Crescent maternity hospital in Baghdad and other civilian buildings on Wednesday, killing many people, hospital sources and witnesses said. The correspondents saw burnt out and twisted cars halted in the middle of the road, drivers burnt to death inside. U.S. planes pounded central Baghdad, hitting residential districts, wounding and killing civilians beyond the ability to count. Again, the carnage is described in Reuters, in the Sydney Morning Herald, in the Scotsman. Rattled and exhausted, the residents of Baghdad are sure the end is nigh. And in this article again, the bombardment is horrific. It is the worst and the most powerful we have ever experienced. They are going from house to house with their bombs. They are destroying our residential neighborhoods. Our people are being dismembered. They are being burnt alive. The Scotsman on April 5th.
And the report in the Times by Mark Franchetti in Nasiriyah describes what the Marines are doing throughout the town. He says many, including children, are gunned down. And a few minutes later, U.S. mortar shells land in front of the houses, going right into the houses, and an entire family is dead. Cobra helicopters fire at a row of houses. There are massive explosions and then it doesn't stop there. And he says, he just goes on and describes bloody attack after bloody attack.
Maya, the International Court, Article 8 of the Rome Statute for the purpose of determining war crimes, intentionally launching attacks in the knowledge that these attacks will cause loss or life or injury to civilians, damage civilian objectives, or widespread long-term and severe damage to the natural environment, which is excessive in relation to the concrete and overall military advantage, attacking or bombardment by whatever means, towns, villages, buildings, undefended, which are not military targets or objectives. Now, this weak and lame international law, which never is applicable to the imperial powers of the day, nonetheless defines the very nature of the genocidal wars, the permanent wars, the continuous wars, the wars of devastation. And let it be said very clearly that all the mewling and whining about inspections, these inspections by the United Nations were designed to render this country defenseless. There is nothing that the Iraqi military, let alone population, can do to defend themselves against this rain of death. There's no anti-aircraft capacity. The Iraqis lack an air force. This is not a war. This is a slaughter. This is a deliberated slaughter for which years and years of stripping this people of the capacity to survive in their civilian infrastructure destroyed by sanctions is conjoined to the elimination of weapons not of mass destruction but of self-defense of an oppressed, impoverished victim people. That is the nature of imperial conquest. That is the real face of imperial war.
And the Marines and the U.S. military, the infantry, the...
The radio show from which that excerpt was taken, and many, many other radio shows by these same broadcasters, can be located at www.radioforhouston.org/takingaim/. Among other things this excerpt describes is the little packages that fall from the cluster bombs, made to appear like packets of food or toys. These same types of little packages have been distributed throughout Palestine by the Israelis on holidays for Palestinian children. The children are attracted to the packages, which they think are candy. They open them up and are horribly surprised. There are many other similarities between the way America is prosecuting this war against Iraq and the way Israel prosecutes her war against the Palestinians, which naturally leads us to wonder if America is under the control of Israel in this war against Iraq. This concern necessitates our going back to the relationship between Israel and Palestine. The best argument I've ever heard for this war is that it's necessary in order to preserve America's honor. And I can even understand that we have to fight to justify our relationship with Israel. However, if 9/11 has created a shift in consciousness, as I believe it has, that allows us to see things we never saw before, especially with the help of the Internet, and if we have found out through the use of the Internet that Israel is in gross violation of the human rights covenants in her treatment of the Palestinians, specifically in the fact that Israel drove 800,000 Palestinians off of the Israeli side of the partition plan, and then used a war to excuse taking another 50% of the land, leaving the Palestinians with only 25% of the entire partition plan, and then, in a third attack against the Palestinians, started bulldozing down their homes and their shops and building up high-rises into which they moved Jews from all over the world. We have to reconsider our relationship to Israel. I certainly understand the argument that we can't let a bunch of terrorists change our relationship to Israel, because that would be capitulating to terrorism, which America has promised never to do. On the other hand, I can no longer support our relationship to Israel, since I have studied the subject and now recognize that the Israelis have betrayed us terribly. They've imposed on our faith and our trust in them, all the money we've given them, to do things that are completely against our will. Specifically, we gave them money under Eisenhower's Adams for Peace plan and nuclear material and nuclear information, and they promised that they would not use it for war. They were supposed to use it for peaceful purposes. But now they have 400 nuclear weapons. JFK wrote a letter to them after a couple of serious incidents in which they had betrayed us, most known as the sinking of the Liberty and the Levon affair, wrote the new prime minister a letter and said, you have to cough up those weapons. You can't continue to have those atomic weapons with our money. Within 3 or 4 months, he was assassinated. I think Israel has to be investigated very seriously. And personally, I think we are going to have to demand that Israel honor the original partition plan and go back to her own side of the partition plan and leave the Palestinians alone. After all, Israel's commitment was not to the Palestinians as much as it was to the United Nations when she accepted Israel as her long-yearned-for homeland state. And there were terms connected to that agreement. Most notably, Israel was under an obligation to allow the resident Palestinians to stay residing on the Israeli side of the partition plan. But almost immediately, Israel used torture techniques, terrorist techniques,
rape, murder, loud, broadcasted messages of Arabic women screaming that it was the end of the world and everybody must flee, to drive off 800,000 Palestinians. Forgetting that, and going to the next question, which is, does Israel have a right to expand her territory when she's attacked? The first point I need to make is that she was not attacked by Palestine. Israel was attacked by the five neighboring Arab states. And therefore, Israel didn't have a right to take, as the spoils of war, property belonging not to those five Arab states, but to Palestine. I feel that Israel has violated her commitment to the United States and the United Nations, and for this reason we have a right to demand that she fulfill her contract or have the entire contract rescinded. I think that criticizing Israel doesn't make a person a Nazi. However, I do admit that I argue against the demonization of Hitler, just as I argue against the demonization of most demonized characters of history. And I also argue against the deification of historical characters. I think both is almost always a mistake. Now, because of this, because of the intense demonization of Hitler, I have studied him a little bit. And I have gone to the extent of finding his artwork and downloading it and putting it on my website, because I knew that if I was right about my hunch, if I had been a victim of a vast propaganda campaign which had made me hate this man and fear this man, it would show up in his artwork. And he is quite an artist. He's done thousands of paintings. Actually, you might call them, I don't know what you call watercolor. I don't know if you call that a painting or not. But he has done thousands of them, and I have them on my website at www.monamontgomery.com to assist other people who want to get a perspective of this man. It's not that I love Hitler. It's that I don't want to be brainwashed by propaganda, and it's very clear to me that we've been very, very brainwashed regarding Hitler. The whole idea of even suggesting that you might look at his artwork is enough to get me demonized. And that shows there's something wrong with the historical treatment of this man, who is, after all, only a man. He's not a god, and he's not a demon. So, go to my website, and you can see Hitler's artwork, and what you will see is a very normal, in fact, unusually pleasant, moderate man, in love with the world, in love with landscapes, in love with his girlfriends. And this man is by no means a demon. That doesn't mean that I worship him. I don't. I understand that his war tactics were abysmal, and that he caused the death of millions of Germans because of his mistakes on the battlefield. But as far as his personal life is concerned, I am convinced, after looking at his artwork, that he is not a homosexual, he's not a sadomasochist, he's not a sexual deviant. And that's enough to tell me that history has maligned this person to the point where there has to be a revision of the history. Okay, first of all, I have never said that I revere Hitler. I'm accused of that, but that's not my position at all. I think that he needs to be examined as a human being. And what I find, I have been unable to analyze his battle strategy because I don't have any understanding of battle strategy, but I have been told that it's abysmal, and I accept that as true. The most important thing to me about Adolf Hitler is that he stands out in history as one man who dared to defy the communist regime that was coming out of Russia next door. After the assassination of the Tsar, the entire property-owning class was murdered on their homes, on their farms, by thugs who came up from the Khazar Mountains, I think, and were organized by the leaders of the Communist Party to become a new police force. They went around, and after they'd finished off the 30 million property owners, they killed off the police, the officers in the army, the intelligentsia, the nobility, and the aristocracy. This is a bloodbath that we're talking about. This is something that any thinking person would hate and would be appalled at. Yet you can't help but notice that it's almost never brought up when people discuss demons. They don't talk about Russia, the communists. Once in a while you hear something about Stalin, but he wasn't the worst part of this bloodbath. It was Lenin and his crew that really did most of the damage. It's true that Stalin did try to purge the party of Jews, which had completely overrun the Communist Party, amounting to 90% of the Politburo and 50% of the party members. But Stalin isn't the real bad guy here. The real bloodbath occurred before Stalin, and it was at this bloodbath that Hitler was looking when he said it's not going to happen in Germany. So he started giving speeches about how Germany could sever herself from, for example, the Rothschild-run World Bank, and he did that. He went off the gold standard and started using some kind of monetary system I don't understand, sort of like shares of stock, I think, where a farmer would trade with a tradesman, and it, for some reason, it made Germany prosper because they got under the thumb of the World Bank. Of course, the communists didn't like this because he was standing directly against the communists, and they went around to his speeches and made all kinds of problems for him. And in 1933, they actually declared war on Hitler. International Jewry declared war on Hitler because of his stand against the Jews, who were the communists. And then, in accordance with the rules of international law, he very correctly put them into concentration camps, since they had, after all, declared war on him. We were doing the same thing to the Japanese. In fact, Hitler's concentration camps were put up after America's concentration camps. It is not true that he had a policy of killing off the Jews. There was no genocidal intent. The documents reflect that he was trying very hard to get them out of Germany into their long-yearned-for homeland state, first in Madagascar, and then to the east of Russia. But he failed because America and England went against him, which surprised him. He expected them to be on his side. What happened, how that war got started, was that he did some kind of a deal with Stalin, that he was going to take half of Poland and Russia was going to take the other half. And then this was some kind of a setup, because when both of these world leaders took their share of Poland, it was Hitler that was attacked by the Allies, and they just figured Stalin could have his half of Poland. As for the 6 million figure, that's been in dispute for a long time, and I won't go into that except to say that the Jews themselves have backed down on that too. I think they're at either a million figure or a 2 million figure, or some of them still think it's 4 million, but I personally think it's closer to a couple of 100,000. The deaths in the concentration camp were not caused by gas chambers. There were none. Even the Jews themselves have backed down on that. The deaths were caused by typhoid fever, which is caused by lice. The cure for lice is to fumigate the clothing and the hair, and that's why the hair was shaven. They were stripped naked when they came into the camps. The clothing was fumigated with Zyklon B, which for a long time was touted by the Jews as being the agent used in the gas chambers, but we don't believe that either. I mean, because there were no gas chambers, and we know what Zyklon B is used for. It's used as a pesticide. Then there's the question of the cover-up after the Second World War. Why is it that in 7 countries you're not allowed to question history? Why is it that in Germany, if you say the things I just finished saying, I would have to go to jail for 5 years? You think this is in the interests of justice, this incredible infringement against free speech? Why is there only one event in history that you're not allowed to research and study and talk about? And yet this is true, unbelievable, but true. In 7 countries, Switzerland, Australia, I'm not sure about Australia, Switzerland, Germany, England, Sweden now, Canada, Australia. Yes, Australia just passed a hate speech law. You're not allowed to say anything that can possibly be construed as intimidating a member of a minority race. It sounds very pretty, but not when you see how they apply it. They apply it that if you research the gas chambers, for example, the 6 million figure, for example, or whether or not Hitler had an intent to exterminate them or was just trying to transport them, this is considered to be so intimidating to the Jewish race that you can go to jail for hate speech just for discussing these matters. Clearly, in my opinion, this is a cover-up, and it's further evidence of a crime. The crime being the complete propaganda campaign to convince the world that the German race is guilty of heinous crimes which they never committed. The motive to get Israel put into place and to make money off of this massive Holocaust industry, which I think I have heard has netted them $1 trillion in profit. During the Second World War, the German race was an unusually high civilization. They had literature, sculpture, paintings. They had everything that a civilization is supposed to have, which the Jews have never come close to. I think that was one of the reasons that the Jews decided to exterminate the white race. Hitler was not an upper-class man. He was a middle-class or lower-class man, and he was very enthralled with the upper-class ideals, the way the aristocracy conducted itself, the way they walked and talked and dressed, and the politeness with which they treated each other. And he fell in love with Eva Braun, who was a beautiful platinum blonde, and he saw himself, I think, as sort of a movie star character, and he was very, very impressed with himself. But the Jews hated him because they hated everything about white society that he loved. They hated what they call the uptightness, the stodginess, the discipline, the workaholism, all of the things that make the white race great. The Jews wanted Hava Nagila, sexual immorality, a more easygoing kind of a lifestyle that the Germans wouldn't tolerate. So they decided to destroy the white race. That would make it a lot easier. Then they could control the world. In order to do this, they went about the business of demoralizing all humankind by promoting the communist platform. Of course, they never intended to live under this horrible rule themselves, but they did know that the way to destroy a country is from within, and so they promoted the idea of forcing America to open the borders. This would destroy her sovereignty, promote homosexuality and illegitimacy. This would demoralize the nuclear family that is the essential cell of any civilization, mock religion and convince everyone to be agnostic and atheistic. This certainly demoralizes a lady or a gentleman. And they've done all of these things. You see, our borders are being overrun by almost 1 million illegal aliens a year. They're coming into our country, overburdening our medical systems, our educational systems. We're not even allowed to have a language anymore. The illegal aliens come across our borders and demand that we teach everything in Mexican, which is ridiculous. We have a right to an integrity, a peoplehood, an identity. But all of this has to be destroyed in order for world communism to take place. So when 9/11 hit, that's exactly what happened. More damage to the American culture was imposed on us. The borders were left more open. More influx of illegal aliens were encouraged. Fanny packs are being given to these illegal aliens so that they can get across our borders without having a bad night's sleep. We have water stations for them so that they can come over more easily. Our government is clearly responding to 9/11 by destroying, not protecting the country. That's not even to mention the fact that the treasury is being completely depleted by this war against Iraq, which, as far as I'm concerned, serves no one except Israel, Iraq's ancient enemy. Well, after World War II, the communists got in control. Of course, they had won the war. So they had a typical kangaroo show trial known as the Nuremberg Trials. We've been told by Abby Mann, the writer who won the Academy Award for Judgment at Nuremberg, that these were very honorable trials. But in fact, they were your typical communist show trial. I don't think Hitler used them as a scapegoat. I think they caused trouble for Hitler by allying themselves with the communists in Russia. And Hitler was not going to allow Germany to be taken over by the communists because he'd seen the bloodbath that occurred after the assassination of the Tsar, and he knew that's what would happen to the German race. If there was anybody exterminate anybody, it was the Jews trying to exterminate the white race and doing a very good job of it in Russia, where they killed ultimately between 65 and 100 million white Christians. And that's just too many for anybody to push under the rug in the interest of being polite. The white race is definitely under attack. Our numbers have gone down from 25% in 1950 to only 8% of the world's population today, and it's not purely an accident. A lot of it's caused by white people just not standing up for themselves, not encouraging their white children to marry other white children, and just basically being too nice to everybody. But there is also an actual attack on the white race perpetrated by the Jewish communists, who correctly understood that if they were to take over the world and make the whole world into a communist state, they would have to get rid of the white race, because the white race is not controllable, as are the non-whites. And in order to have a communist totalitarian world state, you need a world full of controllable people. So, at any rate, the white race does have a right to survive, and it should be encouraging its children to marry within the race in order to preserve the race, because it's a nice race. And it would be a tragedy for the white race to bow gracefully off of the stage of humanity just in the interest of political correctness. It's interesting to see the looting that's going on. It reminds me of what I've read about the Russian Revolution. Most of you know that Lenin was taken by boxcar to assassinate the white Christian Tsar, after which there was the same kind of activity that you're seeing right now on your television screen. The way they worked it is the people who were in charge of the Communist Party, sort of elite, upper-class party bosses, excited the mob, the lowest level of the Russian people, the criminal class, and got them to do this kind of looting and gave them the power and told them to go out and kill all of the landowners and the police and the officers in the army, the intelligentsia. So what we're looking at here is very, very much like the beginning stages of the Russian Revolution, where you see the lowest level of gangsters. If you notice, some of these kids are making gang gestures by, these, when you take the victory sign with your two fingers and put it down into the ground, that's a gang gesture. And they've got real low-level people out there celebrating and getting them excited and encouraging them to loot, not just the castle, but also stores and shops. Now it'll be interesting to see if there's a bloodbath to follow, or if the Americans are able to or decide to control this mob. It looks to me like we've found a new product that we can market with impunity throughout the world and forever, that product being revolution. What you're seeing on your TV right now is a revolution. The party bosses, that's us, we've gone in and assassinated the Pope or the Tsar, or in this case, Saddam Hussein. Then we froth up the rabble and get them to tear the place apart. That gives us more things to rebuild when it's time, when we get the rabble under control, depending on what we do with these rabble. Shall we send them out to murder all of the upper class people, or shall we let the upper class people live? In any case, there's more money to be made in rebuilding this country. Now that we've spent $100 billion tearing it down, I wonder how much it'll cost to build it up. Conceivably another $100 billion. Then we just go on to the next country and play the game all over again. depending on how much oil or resources that country has, we can keep ourselves going forever. Well, we may be seeing a communist takeover here in Iraq right now. The first step in a communist takeover, according to what I've read about Russia, is you assassinate the leader. Then you organize the rabble. You free them up, loosen them up, get them used to stealing, get them used to feeling like they, the criminal class, can take over the rest of society. Then you sick them on the upper class, and they go around murdering and killing. In Russia, they killed 65 million people by the time the revolution was done. One thing they might be doing is get the Kurds to go against the other groups of people. Then you have some kind of a forced integration system where people who are completely divergent socially are forced to live too close together. That requires a lot of administration. And of course, administrators have to be paid. So what we might be doing is setting up a system that is going to cost a whole lot of money to keep in place. And of course, you know where that money's coming from, don't you? It's going to be coming right out of the taxpayer, the American taxpayer. Even if they get those oil wells going full tilt, and even if the United States gets all of that money, they can't produce more than $25 billion a year. The war has already cost us $100 billion. The administration of this new government could easily cost $50 billion. Did I say million? I meant to say billion. So we may be in a situation where it costs more to administer this new regime, whatever it is, than they can get out of those oil wells, in which case the taxpayer will be supporting this new this new society, whatever it turns out to be. There's a very real fear on the part of Iran, Turkey, and Syria that the Kurds are trying to break away from Iraq, and they don't want that to happen. So, I believe we will be staying in with our interim administration for 2 years to prevent that. That means that there's a very real danger that there's going to be more corruption, since now we'll be in the position to administrate the country we've just destroyed. We're already seeing the contract to clean up the oil spills given to Halliburton without opening it up to other bids. And Halliburton has been the focus of very serious scandals. So it looks like the Bush administration's military-industrial complex will be getting the benefit of this war in the form of all of the contracts that will be awarded and paid for by the American taxpayers to rebuild the country. Here's an article from Arab News that says this looting is taking place in the outskirts of Najaf in Iraq, and that this Iraqi coalition of national unity has taken to looting and terrorizing the neighborhood with impunity. In one case, they went to a man's house and demanded that he give him his car. He refused, so they beat him up and took it anyway. Quote, "They steal and steal. They threaten us, saying, 'We are with the Americans. You can do nothing to us.' This sounds so much like the Russian Revolution." I don't recognize fundamentalist Christians as being genuinely religious people. I recognize fundamentalist Christians as being insane, manipulable, and dangerous. The takeover in Syria, for example, which I think occurred in the 1960s. I'm not sure exactly what year. But Syria was taken over by a totalitarian state in the 60s. And here's how the way it's accomplished. The dictator gets in control, and he's, of course, not a believer or any kind of a religious man. He's simply, or a group. This is simply a group of people who want to take over the state and institute a totalitarian regime. They create a bond with the fundamentalist religious people of the area and empower them, give them the best jobs, and give them the duty of bashing all of the thinking religious people. And that's how you do a totalitarian takeover. There has to be a marriage between the dictators and the fundamentalists of the region. In the case of America, there is a marriage between the dictators, the communists, and the fundamentalist Christians that ends up with the society in general as being oppressed. Freedom of speech is destroyed, freedom of thought, freedom of movement, freedom of association. After the Second World War, there were the Nuremberg trials, if you'll remember, in which it was proved that Hitler's Germany was a terroristic state of magnificent proportions. It was proven through the testimony of witnesses that there were gas chambers, steam chambers, electrocution chambers. One of the stories is that hundreds of Jews were put into a room with a cement floor. Water was put on the floor, and massive electrical shocks basically fried these hundreds of Jewish people, after which the water was let out of the room. The floor moved up in a huge angle so that all of the body parts and ashes and bones fell down into some kind of a pulley which took them off into a mass grave. There were other confessions, and when you read the transcript you see that these confessions are so extreme and impossible technologically and contradictory as to not be credible. Further investigation has discovered that this Nuremberg trial, which is held up as some kind of a wonderful breakthrough in jurisprudence, was in fact nothing more than a communist show trial in which history was rewritten and communist propaganda was spread throughout the land to convince people that Hitler, not Stalin, was the great historical Satan. Joe McCarthy was a witness to these trials, and one of the men on the tribunal, one of the judges, was from the United States Supreme Court. The United States Supreme Court washed his hands of the trials, came back to America, and announced that they were a communist show trial, which we were very familiar with in those days. The communists have a reputation for these show trials, in which witnesses are tortured and testimony is elicited to rewrite history the way that the communists want it. Joe McCarthy was one of these people who came over to America and said, we have to stop this from happening in America. The communists have gotten in control of the Nuremberg trials, and they're going to try to get in control of us here. Remember the House of Un-American Activities Committee, in which it was revealed that our media was being taken over by communists. Hollywood was being taken over by communists. We had a blacklist, and our communist writers were all sent to England. Shortly after that, Joe McCarthy started finding out that these communists had embedded themselves in our government, and he was right on his way to pointing out that Eisenhower was involved with this communist takeover. And Eisenhower was, in fact. Eisenhower had done deals with Stalin that are very nefarious, and I won't bother going into them now. But the point is, ever since Joe McCarthy was basically assassinated or put out of good repute, it's been a subject unfit for discussion that we should worry about communists in our country. And so from that time on, we've seen the communist takeover in the form of promotion of atheism, illegitimacy of children, homosexuality, prayer being taken out of the school, agnosticism and atheism being embraced, and all of the things that give a man strength, autonomy, and the ability to question authority are being stripped from us here, as well as, of course, our borders being taken down, which destroys our sovereignty. Let me just bring up the point of the way Joe McCarthy's been treated by history then. Joe McCarthy is the man who set up the House of Un-American Activities Committee in the United States, in which he was trying to weed out disloyal elements from America, his premise being that the United States of America had no responsibility to give, to welcome elements that wanted to destroy the United States of America. And he got a good reception. It was understood at that time among people with conscience that a country didn't harbor people who were trying to destroy the country. So he was able to get rid of a lot of communists who were taking over our media. However, the communists won. And by use of the media, they convinced the American people that America did have a duty to house dissident elements because of the First Amendment, which gave people the right to free speech. So here's an example. Oh, and then after Joe McCarthy was laid to rest, his writings became disreputable. You can't even find them anymore. His name became a source of ridicule. And the whole idea of hating communists became unpopular in America. I think this is a good point to discuss because I think this is when America's downfall began. It became unpopular to despise people who were trying to tear your culture apart. And that is the beginning of immorality. When you stop being allowed to hate evil, you're introducing atheism. You're introducing treachery, treason, and I think that is what happened. I think Joe McCarthy needs to be resurrected. Well, I think America has a problem because we don't prepare our soldiers properly. We start them off in schools that are integrated, so these kids have been on buses 3 hours a day, all during their school career, from class one to class whatever, when they stop integrating them. They put the black kids together with the white kids. The retarded kids go into these classrooms. The teachers are not allowed to criticize any of the children, or it's a $1 million lawsuit against the school. So what has happened is that we've created a way of teaching children which involves getting them all into the same room and then leading them in whatever activity you can lead all these children from all these divergent backgrounds in. We don't separate the intelligent kids out anymore so they can go faster with harder lessons and go on to college and become PhDs and become officers in the Army. That's considered politically incorrect. So by the time kids get into the Army, they've been dumbed down doing these silly exercises that they can all do in unison, and then now little Johnny's gonna do his little hand movement, and now little sissy's going to do her hand movement, and they put them through all of the classes up through grade 12 and into college doing this because they can't bear facing the fact that the state-imposed religion of the United States of America is based on a fallacy. The state-imposed religion of the USA is diversity and multiculturalism and genetic equality. That creates an army that has no capacity to question authority in a meaningful way. Of course, they can't follow orders either, because you have to have one to have the other. What kind of an army do you have when a man doesn't know how to go up to his superior officer and tell him there's a problem? I'm not even going to the level of being able to spot the problem. But if you don't have proper interaction between superior and inferiors, you don't have an army. And we've been taught here in America that authority is always bad and that you should never question authority. What you do in the face of authority is sullenly resent it and give handshakes and little hand signals to your fellow buddies who also hate the authority, and create this I love everybody sort of a mentality that doesn't work on the battlefield. We are being tested on the battlefield, and we've already been exposed as not being able to fight as well as the British. So we're already facing our own failure. Now what's going to happen here is that we're going to win or lose, depending on how you define win or lose. But we're not being told the truth by our media. And the truth is that there are fights going on right now in which our soldiers are being killed by Arabs from other nations who have come in from other countries, other Arabian countries, based on this concept of jihad. And this is just the beginning. You want to call that a win? I call it a problem that needs to be faced and dealt with. Well, we haven't heard yet from the Iraqi people. We've only heard from the most lower class elements of Iraqis, that being the Kurds and the juvenile delinquents. We'll know better what's going on in Iraq when we hear from the majority of upper class Iraqis. Well, all we've seen so far is the takeover of a country, setting free some juvenile delinquents who naturally are very happy to get out of jail, but you know there's something unstable about them because they're not just making signs of victory with their hands. They're making those upside down signs of victory that they shake in, you know, toward the ground like the gangland signs. I guess those gangster signs are universal. So that's one element that we are taking pictures of to show how happy the people of Iraq are. Other than that, the only people that we're seeing jumping up and down in happiness are the Kurds. And they have long been the disenfranchised element of Iraq, and it's kind of like going into the worst ghetto in Los Angeles and telling the Negroes down there that we've just taken over the United States and aren't they happy, and handing them a bunch of flags to wave. They're going to be jumping up and down saying, good, you killed Bush, we're so happy. So first of all, we don't really know what the majority of the Iraqis feel about the takeover. It's so arrogant for any country to think they're going to be welcomed with open arms just because they're beautiful that it makes thinking people suspicious of the true motive. Since it's insane to imagine that we're doing them a favor. That's like a man raping a woman and think he's going to marry him for showing her how wonderful sex is. It's a complete insane megalomaniacal fantasy. I think all men might have that fantasy, but after 3 seconds of thinking about it, nobody really thinks that they are so handsome, so wonderful, so charming that a woman or a country wants to be raped. We have to step back from this kind of an allegation and ask ourselves, what is the true motive for going in? Because it can't possibly be because Iraq wants us to rape her. That's where all of these conspiracy theories come out of the woodwork. People are desperately trying to figure out what is the real reason. Why are we going into Iraq? What is the underlying motive here? And that's when people start listening to the people around them, like the Chinese, the Turkish, the French, the Germans. Even the Saudi Arabians have something to say about this activity, and they're speaking with one voice. America, you are being unfair to attack Iraq when Israel is a worse violator of human rights and covenants of the United Nations and treaties. Israel is your problem, America. Israel is your problem. And eventually, thinking Americans start saying, could it be that Israel is our problem? Now, once you've gotten that far with your logic, okay, once you've taken these steps, A, no, we're not going in there for their benefit. Rape is not the way to make friends. So that's not true. B, Israel is the problem. Then it's not but a tiny logical step forward to notice that Iraq is part of what's known as Greater Israel, which is all the property from the Nile to the Euphrates, that Israel is an expansionistic state, and that it just might be that we are planning to serve Greater Israel on a platter to Israel. And that's where that theory comes from, because we know damn well they are not going to rise up and throw flowers on us after we rape them.
That's all for tonight, folks. Thanks a lot. And I'll be talking to you again next week. Same time, same station. Good night now.